Welcome to the Rent to Retirement Podcast, your resource for passive real estate investing and retirement strategies. If you're new to real estate or planning your financial future, you're in the right place. Join us at renttoretirement.com to find your path to financial freedom and an easy, carefree retirement. Enjoy the show.
Hey, Renter Retires, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode, and I am here with Zach LeMaster, the founder and CEO of Renter Retirement, and we are joined today by two people. You will see Vinny, he is the equity sales manager at DeRosa Group, and he is joined by Matt, who just so happens to be the founder and general manager of DeRosa Group. So gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
It's an honor to have you to be here, Adam and Vinny, Adam and Zach, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So we're going to be talking today about syndications. Most people probably heard the word. Most people probably know what it is. But tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are and why in your real estate journey, you know, you dove into the syndication route instead of, you know, the other routes that you could have gone.
Well, I already went those routes, Adam. Yeah. And so I've been real estate investing full time for 17 years. I did the self-managed single family home. I did some commercial development of the new construction. I've done some fix and flip, but probably about four dozen fix and flips. So all kinds of different facets of real estate, and they're all great. But what I love about syndication is it allows us to really care for the mission of our company in the best way, which is to transform lives through real estate. It allows us to give just a financial offering that's outside of Wall Street to people to build their wealth in a 100% hands-off product, very similar to turnkey rentals, by the way, but it's just an alternative where someone's investing alongside us, or we do all the doing, and we're able to take down way larger real estate projects than we would be able to on our own. That's what makes syndication such a beautiful thing, is that I can give access to investors to something they wouldn't have access to on their own, and enables us to take down projects that are much larger, and it enables us to make a bigger difference in the residents of the multifamilies that we buy by assembling a group of investors to join us on that journey.
Matt, I love the way that you phrase that, join us on that journey, and talk about, you know, partnering with other investors to scale what you're doing, right? It really has a larger impact. And for anyone that's unfamiliar with you, I'd like to dive in a little bit more specifically on your history. But I mean, you're very familiar in the syndication real estate space in general. You know, you're teaching boot camps and for Bigger Pockets and writing books for them. Your wife, Liz Faircloth, runs the Invest Her community, which is huge. And I know that we've sponsored a lot of those events and absolutely love that community. So You're all over the place, and people have probably heard your name or seen you on multiple occasions.
Whether they like it or not. Yeah. They have a fair cloth name out there in the real estate world. And I'm grateful that my wife's built the absolutely monumental company, the Real Estate Invest Her, which started out as a hobby, just her and her friend doing a podcast talking about women in real estate investing. And blink your eyes, and now she's got 20,000 women in her following and 60 meetups, meeting up every month of women all across the world. Like, it's an international community now. So
that's, you know, amazing.
Pinch ourselves in that. But what we do is we just try and make what we do accessible to everyone. And we try and teach people that want to learn how to do syndications. And we also try and give a path to people that want to come in and do it and join us passively as an investor.
Anyone that's listening, we've had a lot of different syndicators on the space. And this is actually, just like turnkey is in a lot of cases, syndication is one of these buzzwords that gets thrown out a lot. Probably used a lot by people that maybe shouldn't, or maybe don't really know, you know, what they're doing or have that track record. I've invested in syndications personally that we've lost capital in with the wrong operator. And so it's always very important. That could be true with anything real estate, right? It's all about the people you're working with, going through and doing due diligence on them and the markets and the opportunities. But ultimately, I think when you're lending private money to someone, you need to know that they have a solid track record, that they have systems in place, that they've actually come full cycle on some deals, and it's really a lot of trust. So let's talk about, and to be abundantly clear, out of all the syndication companies out there that we've come across in decade plus of doing this, DeRosa Group is the only group that we are currently partnering with on syndications and plan to continue in the future. So that's an official endorsement for the DeRosa Group.
It's an honor to get that. Thank you.
Yes, and we don't give it out easily. I mean, there's a lot of people. Like I said, we've been burned in the past, but that just makes us better investors in the future. That's our education. So that's very important. If someone wants a personal recommendation, that's it from mm-hmm. me personally and our company. But anyways, I'd like to, like, let's talk about your track record. Can you tell us about the projects that you've done historically to kind of show your success and that you know what you're doing?
Yeah. We've done, well, let's see. We just finished out DeRosa Capital 16, which we named it that, not because that's like my lucky number or anything like that. It was our 16th syndication that we've done. And so the original syndications that we did, DeRosa Capital 1-6, those were all, like, you know, smaller multifamily projects and mostly in Trenton, New Jersey, one in Philly. And then we slowly expanded and got into larger multifamily to the point where we control around 1,800 units in three states. We've just slowly scaled and done the right thing. We also focus on specific markets. So if you brought me a deal in Tulsa, great city, great market, got lots of growth. Not interested, because we're not in that market. You know, it's not a market we're investing in. We're aggressive in two markets in the US, and we would look at a deal in one more market in that. And so I think that a part of our secret sauce is to drill in and to build specific market relationships. We have 1,100 units in Lexington, Kentucky alone, because we really like that market. And so that's enabled us to choose vendors, property managers, market relationship, key people in each market that we're invested in the US, and specifically also in North Carolina too, in Piedmont Triad of North Carolina. So that's a bit of our secret sauce is market focus. Now, I know there's many other syndicators I know that they might own 7 or 8 apartment buildings in 7 or 8 markets in the US, or even in like 5. Maybe they own 2 buildings in one market, but they tend to scatter themselves around a bit, way more than we do.
So when you talk about kind of what Zach was alluding to a little bit, you know, when we tell people turnkey, you know, there's a lot of different definitions. We say, you know, it's built to rent or completely rent ready. You know, nothing that needs to be done to it. Major systems, 10 years. What is your definition of a syndication? Because how big a project does it have to be a syndication? Is anything where you take other people's money a syndication, or what is the definition of a syndication?
Vin, you want to tackle? I can take that one, but I also want to give Vinny I'm doing it on the top. Yeah. Let me give my man Vinny here a chance to tackle that one. You want to give it a try, Vinny?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me see. So yeah, but you're exactly right. It's really when investors pool money together, right? Like Matt said earlier in the conversation here, to take down bigger deals than we normally could and have the biggest impact possible. So it's comprised of limited partners and general partners. The operators are the general partners, and the limited partners are the folks who get to enjoy the completely hands-off real estate investing.
Let's talk about the fundamentals more specifically. Like, let's assume that someone has never heard of a syndication. Can we just go through exactly what all those terms mean? I mean, when I look at a syndication,
it's so much jargon, Zach, in the syndication world, and it's like the syndicators. It's like we could play BS bingo with all the words that get thrown out, from IRR to cash on cash return to syndication, whatever. But it can be explained a lot more simply than it gets explained by people.
So look, when we talk about general partner, limited partner, when I think about a syndication, it's really about you are a private money lender and you're partnering with someone. You're giving your capital to them, the person who's the operator, who's going to go out and increase the value add. And just be cautious. I'll say there's something that I've seen develop a lot more, especially over the past couple of years, is there's people that are calling themselves syndicators that are raising capital and then lending out your capital. And I don't know what the exact term would be, but lending your capital out on it to another project. They're not the ones actually overseeing the project. And it's extremely important to know that you're operating with the people that are actually doing the project, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's like, well, what is their vetting process? You know, it's just another middleman. So, but really, I think people like the idea of a syndication because it is more of a passive approach to participating in real estate. You can still have some tax benefits. We'll talk about that, but you can actually participate in real estate and not have to worry about your tenants and property management. It's more about the team and the deal. But could you break that down? Like, what does a typical syndication structure look like? What can people expect?
Well, there's no rule that says that you got to give investors this percent and the GP has to get another percent. Think like there's two different roles, right? There's the GP and that's the operator. They are the legs in my book, Raising General Private Partner, Capital. Right. Yeah. In Raising Private Capital, I talk about the deal provider. That's the GP. The GP finds the deal, operates the deal, assembles the deal, also assembles the capital for the deal from the equity side, assembles the debt. If the debt needs a personal guarantee, that's the GP that's doing that. And then they drive that deal to success. That they put in mostly time, sometimes dollars, right? But mostly time is their injection into the deal success equation. Then there's the LP. And again, it's fun to use the acronym. It stands for limited partner. And it's you sound smart when you use that word, but really all that is the money, right? That in Raising Private Capital, I talk about is the cash provider. So those two, and the cash provider's putting in mostly cash, maybe a little bit of time to vet the deal, but mostly money. I mean, and the intention is to put in very little, if any, time at all, so that the LP can leverage their time and leverage other people's time, if you will. And those two things, the limited partner's money and the general partner's time, is what the marriage looks like. Now, there's splits. We typically do somewhere between a 70-30 split where the limited partners get 70%, the GP gets 30, or even sometimes we've done an 80-20 split. It depends on what the deal structure needs. It depends on the profitability of the deal we're buying. To get investors really excited to get, I need to know what split level I need to do to get my investors to a heck yes, to get them super excited about the deal. You want to have something that's really fair. It's a big win for investors, but it's also a win for us too, that for putting all that time, we get just compensation for all the time we're putting into. So that's kind of how it breaks down.
With all that's happening right now with interest rates, with housing in general, with builders, all of that, has that impacted kind of the way that y'all are going about structuring your next deals? Or are you just kind of, this is our model, it's still working, we're just going to churn forward with it? Or has your strategy changed at all in the recent few months, or looking forward to the next year or two?
Yeah, so the focus has been for a while and will kind of remain to be focusing on cash flow producing assets. So the number one thing to do in trying economic times like this is to focus on purchasing properties that are going to produce cash flow day one. It allows you, some protection. And then also, part of the prospectus here at DeRosa is increasing the intrinsic value of these properties. So what we talk about value add all the time, and infusing capital into these properties and making them better, from the ground up intrinsically, increasing that property value will protect as well, some of the downside here in these strange economic times, really.
And I'm glad that you brought up the idea of value add, just to understand, again, to be rudimentary here, but to understand the dynamics of a syndication. Generally, what's happening is you have a general partner, a GP, that is your operator, who's finding the deal. To Matt's point, you talked about time, but I actually think like experience and expertise is a big part of that too. Yeah. And they're finding the deal, but they don't have all the capital personally to go out and do the deal. And the deals typically are properties that are undervalued. Maybe the rents are below market value. As we know, commercial assets are valued based on the income of the property versus, an appraisal. So you have the ability to really increase what that value is worth on the building by making it a better operating property. Sometimes doing some renovation and increasing rents or reducing expenses. Then that's usually maybe what a 3 to 7 year timeline, or it happens over time as you get it to market value, and then eventually you have some sort of exit. So usually with a syndication, when you're putting money into a deal, you get a return, and sometimes there's a lapse because it takes time to actually increase those rents. Sometimes there's more vacancy that needs to be filled in that building, and you're receiving a percentage of the income on the property while the GP is going through and doing the renovation, increasing the rents, and then you have a projected exit at some point where the mm-hmm. value is actually increased. And that's where it's kind of a combination. How you earn money in a syndication is, and Vinny, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's throughout the process of doing the value add through the cash flow and performance, but also there is an exit, and that's where you get this IRR, internal rate of return. It's combining everything to look at the full return on the value add. You get to participate in the value add, the equity creation, as well as a cash flow. Did I explain that appropriately or?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And that's really one of my favorite things about multifamily in general is that you can increase the value of a property many different ways, right? You can increase the value of a property by making it better physically, but you can also increase the value of a property by operating it better than it has been in the past. So having some experience there and, you know, operational efficiencies that from lessons learned that you can implement on a new property can increase the value too. So yeah, it comes down to the amount of revenue that property is going to be earning.
And to extrapolate, just build on top of what Vinny just said, what's great about multifamily and it's great about commercial assets in general is that they get valued on how much money they make, right? A single family home gets valued on what the property next door sold for. Or the property around the block that was similar square footage and similar beds and bath. That's what the appraiser is going to value it at, is specific other single family homes around that market. Multifamily gets valued just on how much money it makes. That's it. And if you can make the multifamily make more money by reducing expenses or increasing revenue, then you can do what they call forced appreciation, where I'm driving up the value of the building by just doing good work in the property. So you are in complete control of the bottom line the property makes. So that makes you more money, but it also makes the property worth a lot more based on what that market's cap rate is.
Can you give some concrete examples of just like, you know, what are some quick value adds to either increase income or decrease expenses to increase the worth of that building?
Well, okay, it's one of two things, right? Like I said, it's either expense or revenue. So expense, we go heavily after utility expenses, especially on older vintage properties that were built in the 60s, 70s, 80s. They weren't thinking about, you know, cost reduction or about water conservation back then.
5-star energy rating.
Yeah, no. They were like, what star? You know, what are we talking about, right? You know, and my uncle told me back in the day when a lot of these properties were built, water was free. The town was just provided by the town in your property taxes. You didn't have to pay for water. So why would they conserve water? It's, you know, it's just town just gives it to you, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So now that's not the case. Now you get charged for water. And so saving water is a good thing to do by the planet, but it's also a good thing to do for your bottom line. And so we do water conservation, low flow toilets, aerator shower heads with aerators in them, sink aerators. And you can drop a apartment building's water consumption by around 30% by doing just smart utility saving items, LED lights too, if the landlord's paying lighting. We'd put LED lights in the tenants' units too, because if I can reduce the tenant's electric bill, then they're more likely to stay because their bills go down and they know that it's cheaper to live there than it would be across the street because I'm giving them LED lights. So we'll do that in a unit as well. So that's expense reduction. On the rent increase side, we just do things that tenants are willing to pay us money for. So that could be renovated kitchens, that could be renovated bathrooms, that could be, you know, new lighting packages, like I just said, with the LED. Maybe I charge the tenant a little bit more for doing that LED light package. There's other things that we do, like they're called non-rent, you know, like just non-rental revenue that you can do. Like, this is the new thing these days. It has a funny name, and it's even funnier what it is. It's called valet trash, right? And you can picture like valet parking, but it's called valet trash, where the tenants can, instead of going through the heavy lifting of taking their own trash to the dumpster across the parking lot, they can leave it out in front of their door. And a company will come and pick up their trash and, you know, take it for them. And this is just, you know, white glove service you can offer to tenants, and you get to charge for that. And so if you do a valet trash package, you can get $25 per unit. And it is a nice convenience, you know, it's, you know, think about that. I'd love to just put my trash right up in front of my house and, you know, right in front of my front door, and I didn't have to walk it out to the curb. Great. So
first world problems.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, that's what it is. I mean, I'll give you another Looney Tunes thing that we're doing these days in the first world problems. We're developing a dog spa. We have a property in North Carolina that had an extra bathroom in the leasing office. So we took the bathroom out, and we're going to take the plumbing utility there, and we're going to put in this fancy pants spa for dogs, for people to bring their dogs. It's got a blow dryer in there. You can wash the dog down. You have to pay for that. You know, and it also enables people that love their dogs to bring their dogs to our apartment complex and live there. And guess what? We charge a pet fee. you know? And so that's a non-rental revenue item you can do as well. You just really do things that make tenants' life a little bit better that they would like to have. And you charge a little, like a reasonable increase for it. So we can get compensated for that. And before you know it, you've made the property worth, you know, a lot more than what you paid for it by doing the right thing by tenants and by, you know, increasing your bottom line, which thereby does the right thing by your investors.
Yeah, if I could add to that too, I think one of the biggest increases you'll see in revenue is just from turning around the occupancy. A lot of times increasing the occupancy is probably the one of the main drivers there. So one good thing any syndicator should do is take a look at what the market needs and serve know your client base well so that you can renovate these properties to fit that you know idea and what people are looking for there so you can increase occupancy.
How many of these projects are you buying that are there's usually I would assume underperformance on management on all of them. How many of them are like mom-pa owners or a managerial group that just really
not mom and pop don't own a lot of the, you know,
larger
200, 300, 400 unit apartment buildings. Mom and pop own a ton of sub 100 unit apartment complexes. So it's not always that. A lot of times it's corporate owned, it's company owned and everything like that. But there are some mom and pop owners I've dealt with. I mean, we've negotiated a deal with a guy out in Kentucky where he was the son of the builder of the apartment. His father built that apartment complex and he still managed it and owned it. So that does happen, but it's not like some other real estate worlds where a lot of, you know, established companies like ours are going in and buying properties from mom and pop and taking them to the next level. I've done that, but not every deal is that way.
So a lot of with these larger buildings, these corporately owned centers, I mean, is it just that management, they have third party management that maybe doesn't really
No, they try and manage it themselves.
Oh, they're doing self.
You see that? Yeah, if you see that, I know I can smoke we can make that property run like a top, because what you've got is a corporation that thinks that that property management's no big deal and they can just keep that fee for themselves. It's short-sighted, but we know that a good property management company that we use that runs, you know, maybe 10-15,000 units is going to be a way more professionally run operation that know that market much better, and they're not going to just manage the expenses and, you know, you end up shortchanging tenants. It's good to have that third party in there.
Sounds all too familiar trying to manage my own rentals back in the day.
Yeah, no, and me too. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, there's a reason why property management companies are good at what they do is because they do it a lot on a lot of different things. If you're trying to wear the property management hat while also wearing the owner hat, and they're two different hats, while you also do other things in your business, you're not going to do anything well. And so when we see self-managed multifamily, even on the large scale, even with corporations doing it, we know we can typically create real value just by parachuting in a, you know, air quote, real management company.
Yeah. When you talk about kind of the value adds here, I just want to kind of give some general numbers so people can realize it. Cause you're talking about raising rents, and it's not just raising rents, you know, $20 a month. So if you're, let's say you have your 1100 units in Lexington, let's just say it's all one place.
Yeah.
And you're able to do things that raise the rent $50 per door. How much does that actually raise the value of the whole unit?
You're going to make me get out my calculator, Adam.
Well, I got you. Good practice to go through cap rates. Like how do you do a value add? You know what I mean?
And sure. No problem. Let's say I'll give you, this happens. You know, this is a real example that happens sometimes for us. Put an asterisk in this, that when a tenant, when you renovate a unit, you have to wait for the tenant to move out so you can go and do a roll your sleeves up full, you know, turn of the apartment, which can cost us somewhere around $5,000 to $6,000 a unit, right? And that's everything. That's, you know, cabinets and appliances and flooring and paint and lighting, whatever. But let's say I've got a unit that the tenant's lease is coming up, and this just makes it easy math for your question, Adam. Then I say to the tenant, okay, and I don't say it, the property manager does. hey, I see your lease is coming up. And I see you have, you know, the prior owner decided to leave your old school 1960s vintage cream colored, you know, refrigerator here. That's probably older than you are. what if I gave you a brand new stainless steel appliance package with an over the hood microwave over the stove? What if I gave you that, right? If I gave you that, would you be open to paying, let's say for fun, $50 more a month in rent? And the tenant would fall over themselves to say, really? I get the microwave, I get new fridge, put the water on the door, I get the whole thing. Yes, for $50. Absolutely. I know I can get that appliance package for $2,000 installed, right? Because you buy a lot of them. You go to Home Depot, it's not going to be that. But if you buy a lot of appliances like we do for our units, we typically for a full pack like that, for an apartment grade stainless steel finished package, I can get it for $2,000 installed, right? So that fit. Let's do ROI first, and then we'll talk about building value, okay? So $50, that's what the tenant's paying, but they're not really paying that. They're paying that per month. So that's $600 a year, okay? So I'm getting $600 a year in top line revenue for our company for a $2,000 investment. So that's a 30% cash on cash return, right? Hard to find that in today's market, isn't it? You know, but I'm not done yet. I bottom lined that unit in profit by $600, right? Let's say, Adam, that I do, I don't know, 100 unit apartment complex. I'm good enough to do, I can do 20 of those in a year, right? So that's 600 times 20. So I'm making an extra $12,000 per year in additional cash flow for that investment, okay? But I'm not done yet. That increases my bottom line on the property. And what you do is that all that flows to the bottom, which is the NOI of the property, which NOI is simply how much money you made minus your expenses, not your debt service, not the money that it takes to pay your mortgage every month, just your income minus your expenses is equal to the NOI. And that's that's like the profit line of the property. So my NOI just went up by 12 grand, right? Again, round numbers, because I'm a simple man. I divide it by 0.05 on a 5% capitalization rate. That's what you do. You take the NOI and divide it by the cap rate, and that tells you the change in value. I've increased the value of my apartment building by $240,000, Adam. And I'm making another $12,000 a year in bottom line cash flow. And by the way, my tenant's happy because I made that cream colored GE appliance go away. You know, and then they got a fancy pants, you know, stainless steel, and they're happy to pay $50 a month for that, right? And the investment was 40 grand. It's 20 units that I did the work in times $2,000. So I spent $40,000 and I'm making $240,000 in property value. So what I can do is I can then refinance that property and pull that out. I can just have that as future wealth building capital for my investors that comes out when we sell the property, or we could just enjoy the cash flow and know that we've got that much more padding and equity and value of our building.
And then there's the expense write-off of actually putting in those upgrades, right? So goes on and on. We won't even talk about depreciation.
Right. Or I could depreciate them and write them off. You know, I mean, I can claim tax depreciation on them, whatever you want. I mean, there's all kinds of fun things you can do with multifamily because there's a lot. You do things on a small scale level, but you multiply that thing times the amount of units you have, and it becomes a big behemoth pretty quickly.
Start talking real money.
Yeah.
So that just shows the economy of scale, like turning the needle just a little bit, you know, on a large scale can make a huge impact. And that's really why syndicators are in the business they are, and partnering with other people, as we talked about in the very beginning, to make that larger impact. And it's just really cool to see that at work at scale. Same thing would apply to, you know, smaller deals. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Benny.
No, I was going to say to your point about economy of scale, that it becomes such a well-oiled machine to these $2,000 upgrades that we're talking about running through 20 units. It becomes something you can do quickly and efficiently. And it's that's the economy of scale piece.
That's a win-win.
Let's switch gears a little bit. Let's say that someone they've been familiar with syndication. Maybe they've invested in one, had a good or bad experience. I want to talk about how to vet syndicators, but I first want to talk about, like, for someone that's never done this, what does a typical deal structure look like? Do they need to be accredited? What does accredited mean? Mm. What is a typical minimum investment threshold, timeline, and expected type of returns? I can break those down for you guys, but give us a picture.
Yeah, Vin, you want to?
Yeah, so we work with accredited and non-accredited investors. So that's, you know, one thing to establish off the bat there. The way that the things usually work is, you know, we have something under contract and we'll be looking to raise capital, and folks will reach out to us and we'll help go through the kind of the hoops there. And so that's the typical deal structure. We have Class A and Class B investors. And, you know, to get a little bit into the weeds here, our Class A investors, everybody gets equity. And, you know, the way that I like to explain it, though, is our Class A investor is kind of like a debt partnership. That's how they receive compensation. And Matt's here to jump in and clarify if I veer off too much. But that's how I look at Class A, because they're receiving a pref payment paid monthly. So stop there.
When we talk about pref payment, that's preferential payment. That is, you're receiving money prior to the, like, the investors are receiving their capital prior to the general partner.
It's called a preferred return. Yeah. And then the investors are preferred above us, meaning it's a nice way of saying they get paid first. So the first chunk of profit out of a deal after revenue, expenses, debt service goes to investors up to the point that that preferred return hurdle is met. Typically for deals, it's between 6% and 7%. So they put in X amount of dollars, they make 6% to 7% on their money, and then they meet that preferred return hurdle, then they get a chunk of the profit beyond that.
Typically, they can feel pretty confident, like, that at the bare minimum, they're going to get that 6% to 7% preferred return, because it's like, you know, they're getting paid first. If there's any profit squeezed out, equity, then whatever, that, like, they're getting that portion before anyone else gets paid. And just to touch on the accreditation point, so we don't glaze over that.
Yes.
Accredited investors, because there's different ways you can structure different deals with SEC and things like this. Accreditation, correct me if I'm wrong, is someone that has a net worth of over $1 million, excluding primary residence, or someone that individually makes $200,000 a year or combined $300,000 a year gross income. Is that accurate?
That's correct. And then they have to earn that income for the last 2 years. They can't just have gotten a raise last week and now they make over 200K. They have to have made that, and they have to have the understanding that they will make that for the foreseeable future as income.
So you don't have to be an accredited investor to invest in syndications, but some syndications only allow for accredited investors because, frankly, it's easier to go through and structure that, I think. So
yeah, well, the underscore there is, if you're not an accredited investor, it's okay. Most syndicators do offer non-accredited offerings, but you have to have a pre-existing relationship with them. So that means that I can't just go online and see XYZ syndication company's pretty Facebook ad and decide I want to invest with them. You can't do that, because that you have to go and build a relationship first. Not as an interest to invest, just build a relationship with them as a potential place you want to invest, place you want to learn from, whatever it may be. Then once you've established that pre-existing relationship, then you can invest as a non-accredited.
All right. What are the typical minimum requirements to invest as far as capital, at least what you guys see in the industry or what you do? What's the typical timeline? We talked about preferred return.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about, like, IRR and, like, total return over what period of time?
Sure. It's anywhere between 25 to 50K is the typical minimum investment in a deal. Some syndicators have hurdles that are a bit more than that, but that's what I see in the industry. The time frame for the investment could be anywhere from, like, I've seen stuff that's at 2 years. I've seen syndicators that are out there on a 5 year hold on a 5 year target on deals, but they're actually selling sooner. It's just that you sell it when you can meet the best investor return. Our job as a syndicator is to make investors a great return on their money. And if that means I got to sell early, then you do, right? And there's stuff that's out there at 7 to 8 years. And we at DeRosa are working on models that allow people to liquidate whenever they want. This doesn't exist yet, but this is where I see the hockey puck going, if you will, Zach, is I think that eventually you're going to see syndicators, including DeRosa, and we're hoping to lead the charge on this one, to offer the opportunity for investors to have true liquidity, that when they want their money back, they can get it, and not wait for us to sell the property in the future. And if they want to stay in the property forever and hand that equity down to their, and that equity and cash flow down to their heirs, they can. Because a lot of times what happens is the syndicator has to sell to create the liquidity event to give investors their money back. And sometimes investors don't want their money back. They don't want to sell. They want to keep getting the cash flow they're getting, or they want their money to be somewhere. And sometimes when you sell and give investors their money back, you've actually created a problem. It's how, whether that be a tax problem, or whether that be a, geez, what do I do with this money? I got to put it to work. I don't want it to be sitting here. So, so we're working on that model, but there, things like currently it's anywhere from very, very short time frame on a deal to, you know, north of 10 years. It depends on the deal.
So they get this preferred return throughout the time period that, I mean, that's kind of like, I guess, essentially initially it would be the cash flow, right? Like when you give someone, when you invest in a syndication, understand that it's not like you're, in some cases or many cases, it's not like you're going to be receiving that 8% return in day one. Like there takes time to do the value add. If this property is barely cash flowing or negative cash flowing, like they need time to actually lease out the property, do some renovation, do some of the, raise some of these rents. And so, you know, the income may come over time. I think that's one discrepancy a lot of people are unaware of. While you have an anticipated return, like you have to give the operator time to actually do the value add on it to actually receive that. But ultimately you're looking at receiving this potential preferred return. And then with the equity, you get an equity share. I think you mentioned 70-30-70 to the investors earlier on as a standard. And so the investors would split like that 70%, which is, that's the exciting part in my mind, is the participating in that equity spread where you exit the property, you have a raised, increased value, and then you're creating value and you have a percentage of that. So maybe it would look like a 6-7% preferred return with a projected 15% IRR based on your exit strategy. Is that kind of in the range of what you look at? Which they would receive at the end of the syndication, right? Once it sells.
Well, there's one more item that we didn't touch on too much here, but that when we were talking, Adam, when you were talking about the value add strategy, like granular, like remember the appliance example, right? You talk about that. A lot of times what a syndicator, including us, will do is they will capitalize on all the value they've added to the property by doing a refinance. And so that sometimes happens in the, you know, 5-10 year cycle as well. We bought a property in Kentucky for $6.7 million, did a bunch of value add, did everything from playgrounds, added a soccer field of all things, Zach, isn't that cool? Did a bunch of renovations to the units, did some roof work. And then when the property refinanced it, and the property came in at a valuation of $14 million. So almost double what we paid for it. And we were able to pull a good amount of investor equity out and give investors a big chunk of their cash back. What's great about that is that's not a taxable event. That's borrowing money. And so it'd be like if you refinanced your house and took money out of your own home, that's not a taxable event. That's just a loan. And so we were able to give investors a big chunk of their money back and it wasn't taxable when we gave it to them. And that all goes back to their bottom line too, because they get some chips off the table and they're still making a good return, a good cash on cash return on their money, but they've got like half their money is exposed to the deal now. So.
Vinny, I cut you off a long time ago. You were going to add something to
that. Yeah, I was going to say too.
There are non-preferred people too. Yeah.
I was going to say too, because before we were talking in generalities, and I'm glad Matt gave like a really good specific example, but I think one thing worth pointing out here too, and it's because it's not always the standard, it's not what everyone's doing, but DeRosa, we raise capital for deals specifically. As of right now, we're not raising blind pools of funds for, to put access to against a prospectus. And so where I'm going with this is, you know, even though we're speaking in generalities, when that day did come and we had something on the line, and we were, you know, telling folks about it, it would be very black and white in an OM what our projections were, and the business plan there would be very black and white.
They get a look at the deal, you know. So basically, once you have a deal, you're going to be providing all sorts of information about the plan with it, the projected returns, who's the right fit for it. I mean, so it's we're talking in generalities, but it's very specific to the deal that people get familiar. And that's where you get a little bit. I mean, most people want to be passive, but that's where you get some exposure and experience actually looking at an operator to see how they're creating opportunity and how they're underwriting the deal. I mean, that's important.
Yep.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is people need to go out and become Facebook friends with Matt so they can have an existing relationship so that if they're not accredited, they can come in and invest in the next deal. Is that accurate?
It's not even as hard as that. I know. I mean, we're really grateful for our relationship with Rent to Retirement, and so I believe Rent to Retirement has a means that you guys can learn more about us. We've even got some freebie stuff there for you guys to grab through Rent to Retirement's website. You can get a consultation with Vinny. That's really all you got to do, is if you want to consider doing passive work with DeRosa, the pre-existing relationship does not mean that you're like, you know, one of my relatives, or that you know when my birthday is, or whatever it is. It just means that you've had a conversation with a DeRosa team member and they've had a goal analysis, where you want to go, where you want to do, what you want to do, just as any financial company offering you a financial investment should. And that Vinny and his team can do. And just, that's just free consultation over at toretirement.com/DeRosa. And Zach, if it's a good opportunity for me to throw out here, we have a free giveaway on that link too, that I can mention right now if you like.
Please.
So what, and this is of interest for those that, if you guys are looking to actually do syndications yourself, that's great. We still want you guys to be able to do that. And if you're also considering doing passive investments in syndications, you need to consider the market. And the, you could have, Zach, the greatest deal that's got the best cash on cash return, but if it's in a declining market, physical market, you know, like a market that's not doing well in the city or whatever, the MSA that it's in, the deal may not do very well. And so we developed a market analysis tool that people can use to determine if the market you're looking at to invest in, and this applies for anything. This applies for turnkeys, applies for multifamily, it applies for maybe if you want to move to the market, whatever it is. This is a tool that's got, it's got a scoring sheet where you know it's got a, I think 10 factors. Then you add up the score for each factor at the bottom, and then your market gets a score, and it you know, puts it where on the spectrum that market is. And so that's a free giveaway as a thank you to the Rent to Retirement community that we came up with, that is there at renttoretirement.com/DeRosa, so they can grab a copy of that for free.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that with our community. We appreciate that. And also, we have a lot more information just on our website under the syndication page for learning about syndications, learning about your guys' organization. Obviously, we have confidence and have seen your track record and enjoy the value and the education you bring to our community. Just in closing, and maybe Vinny, you could take this one. I mean, who's a syndication right for? Can you talk about your typical investor avatar? Like, if someone's deciding if this is a right path for them to invest passively in, and you know, what does that investor look like? What are things they need to be aware of?
Yeah, sure. It's great for the investor who wants exposure to real estate but doesn't want to spend the time to, you know, find, operate, and manage that real estate. That's really, in a nutshell, what folks who are interested in syndications are looking for. That's what we try to provide.
Is there any, I guess, last pieces of advice you would offer to someone as they're exploring different syndicators? Because there's a lot out there, and it seems like they're popping up all over the place in one shape or form. Is there any advice in terms of like questions to ask, things to vet in terms of if you're going to give someone money, what is important to know? And how do you know that you really have confidence working with someone that is going to perform on that asset?
Yeah, I have an answer to this one too. Anytime you ask this question, the answer always is track record. And that's always the answer because that's probably the best answer. But the one that I'd like to give is, how do you feel talking to the people who are, you know, on the other end of this? Are you going to be on a first name basis with somebody who's managing your money? And are you going to feel like they're taking good care of you? I think those are really important things because, yeah, track record is probably the number one thing you have to look for and a proven track record doing business. So, but besides that, make sure that you're building a relationship with this person because these are longer term investments and you're going to be, you know, talking for a little while. So
absolutely.
And to add to that, and that's a great answer, Vinny, but I would just add a little bit further is that, you know, there's a lot that goes in to syndications and to running multifamily like this. And there's a lot of folks out there that are great at finding deals, but, and that's great. You got a great deal, but the best deal in the world, could fall completely apart without direct management, you know, and without who the property manager is and who on the syndicator's team is managing that property manager, who's the asset manager running the day-to-day over that property manager, delivering their business plan, giving them their goals, pushing them to do renovations and coming up with the off the wall ideas like the one I gave about the appliances and stuff like that. It's when you're vetting a syndicator, it really comes down to who is going to be the one driving that business plan after closing. Because up until recently, up until the market got a little squirrely, just about anybody could find raise the money for and close a deal. That's not the hard part. That's been the easy part up until recently. In that the hard part is actually making that deal make money and making it profitable over the long run.
So, I'll add one more thing before I let Adam close this out, but also checking references, I think, is a huge source. Now, anyone can give out references. When you ask someone for a reference, it could you never know. But I mean, make sure you're checking multiple references and understand what that reference, what their experience has been, and their position. And also just Google people, especially in this space in the real estate industry that we are so public. And I know, if you find negative things online, I mean, that are legitimate, not just people saying random stuff, but if you find negative stuff or, possible legal past history, if there is also, if there's nothing, if you just can't find someone online, like those are, to me, are all negative signs. We obviously know, Matt, your glowing face and reputation is all over the internet, all positive.
Thanks to our work with Bigger Pockets and with YouTube. I feel bad for the other Matt Faircloths in the world because we've made ourselves very Googleable out there.
Those poor souls.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry, guys.
I just have one parting question before I wrap it up here. And that is, I always tell people on the phone, if I ever tell you to buy cash without an inspection, hang up on me. As people are going around and vetting people, what are the things that should make them hang up the phone when they're talking to a syndicator and then realize, this isn't the right thing?
This isn't the right deal. For me, in today's market, I would hang up the phone if the deal is 100% based on appreciation, where you've got a deal that, it's going to make a very, very minimal rate of return. And then all of a sudden, magic fairy dust gets sprinkled on the deal, and the deal is going to sell for double what the syndicator paid for it 5 years from now. That's hoping that the market doesn't change or that the market is going to be favorable when they sell. And that's factoring on something that you can't control, And so if the syndicator's business plan has things that are all in their control, like, raising rents, doing the right implementation to, buy tenants and building things that make the tenants want to stay, those are things they can control. But if they're relying on the market to be favorable at the time of sale, I would run the other way, because that is certainly, that is something the syndicator is pulling out their crystal ball and hoping that the tea leaves are going to be just right when they go to sell. And there's no telling if that's going to be the truth or not.
All right. Fantastic. Well, Matt and Vinny, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Look forward to talking with you more in the future and working with you on all these ventures. Again, everybody, go check out rentretirement.com/DeRosa. You can check out that market analysis tool, get your free consultation to establish that relationship with them. If you decide to move forward with it in the future, that's rentretirement.com/DeRosa. You two, really appreciate it. If you have any questions for them, feel free to send it to podcasts@rentretirement, and either we'll answer it or we'll get it to them to get that answered. Really appreciate everybody listening, and we'll talk to you on the next episode.